south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came up to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started. Now, I'm sure most of you know that the USA is basically the only country in the world that imposes a tax on worldwide income. Not just income produced within the country. And that means even if you were born in a U.S. hospital and your parents were 100% foreign, then when you get old enough to get a job, you will technically get taxed by the U.S. for all your worldwide income. And that's no matter where you choose to live. You will always owe the U.S. tax man his 30 pieces of silver. Though I'm sure it's up to 30, 40, 50, maybe even 100 pieces of silver by now, huh? Anyway, as usual for captive U.S. citizens, the tax man's going to give it to you right up the keister. And by the way, did you know that the average fee that tax preparers charge in the States is between $200 and $400 for a person who doesn't own his own business? You know, the average working class Joe or Jane. And that even includes nameless, faceless tax preparers like you see at H&R Block. And here's what's sadly funny about that. Down here in Latin America, 9 out of 10 gringos and expats don't even pay $200 to $400 a year for the actual tax bill. And by the way, not too far from the subject, the average person down here who owns a house or a condo rarely pays over $500 a year in property taxes. And of course, I'm talking off the gringo tourist trail. Forget about Panama, Argentina, Costa Rica, and Chile, since every year they're jacking up the property taxes more and more, trying to achieve first world parity, of course. The idiots. And what do you get for it? Nothing. Anyway, I know many, many gringos and expats off the tourist trail that have houses that would be $300,000 or even $400,000 in the States, and not one of them pays over $500 a year in property taxes, which is reason 2,426 why you should definitely get the hell out of the U.S. Or was it 2,427? I forget. Where was I? Oh, yeah. Don't think that foreigners giving birth on U.S. soil doesn't occasionally happen. In fact, last year, over 20,000 foreigners had babies that way in the States. And I'm not just talking about pregnant Latinas trying to slip in to give birth just to claim that U.S. citizenship and all those future benefits like food stamps and welfare that it entails. Though that does happen a lot more than we'd like to believe. There are also some completely innocent cases where foreigners give birth in the States. For example, if your mother was from England or France or Ireland on vacation, and you or your brother or your sister just happened to pop out, that would mean that your brothers, sisters, or you are technically U.S. citizens and are required to report and pay taxes on your worldwide income forever. Isn't that nice? Even if you never, ever in your whole life return back to the United States for one day. Now, you probably also know that you're much better off living outside the U.S. if you're a U.S. citizen for a lot of reasons. Not the least of which is how U.S. citizens living outside the States are treated tax-wise by their own government, the IRS and Uncle Sam. You might recall that living more than 330 days a year outside the U.S. allows you to get that special foreign earned income tax exemption of $99,200. That's for the latest tax year of 2013, which, by the way, is up from $95,500 last year. So I repeat, if in 2013 you made more than $99,200 and you lived outside the U.S. for more than 330 days and you made that money outside of the U.S., you have to report and pay taxes on any amount over that. And by the way, that includes your FICA and Social Security portion too. Though believe me, there are legal ways around that too, but it gets a little complicated, so I won't go into it right now. Now for some of us, $99,500 tax-free is a pretty big number. Now, I admit, I've been down here a long time, and I don't know very many expats at all who make that kind of money. After all, down here, if you're off the tourist trail, to live like a person making $100,000 a year, you only have to earn about a quarter of that. And that's why a lot of laid-back expats I know don't care to push themselves that hard. Why should they? When you get down here yourself, you'll know what I mean. Though many of them could jump right back on that first world treadmill down here in Latin America and make six figures, they just don't care to. They hardly feel like jumping back on the treadmill after they liquidated practically everything up north just to get the hell off. And about that 330 days out of the U.S. bit. In order to qualify for that near 100 grand foreign earned income exemption, well, because that whole calculation can be quite detailed, I'm kind of simplifying it here. Just know that it's not always true that you have to be 330 days or more outside the U.S. to get that exemption. There are other ways to legally qualify and still remain in the U.S. for most of the year, but it's too much to go into right now. If you want more detailed info on that, I talk a lot about that on my new Five Flags course, which you can get at expatwisdom.com, and I talk a lot about that at my Expat Wisdom seminar, too. Anyway, just remember, you don't have to be out of the United States more than 330 days a year to get that big $99,500 foreign earned income tax exemption. No matter what lawyers and tax accountants might have told you, that 330-day rule is not strictly true. There are other ways to qualify. But you see, if you happen to live in the U.S. full-time, none of that applies. You get no such tax break on foreign income. You get taxed on all your income, even if you don't earn a single dime from a U.S. source. And here's the thing. Up to now, it's been the U.S. government that's been the only one that taxes you on your worldwide income, which is reason 1,276 why you should get the hell out of the U.S. as soon as you can. Though it could be reason 1,277. I forget. Anyway, don't think that all other foreign government tax authorities don't know this and aren't just chomping at the bit to get a piece of that action. That is, tax the crap out of their citizens by hitting them with a tax on worldwide income, not just what's earned within the country itself, just like the States. Well, I know for a fact that a lot of countries, especially European countries, have given some lip service to passing a bill like that. But no other country till now has had the balls to do it, since most politicians believe it would be the kiss of death for re-election, for anyone who supported a bill like that. But you see, since politicians are ruthless, cunning, and power-hungry, not to mention ass-wiped, thieving scumbags too, and I'm being kind. Anyway, if there was a way to get a law like that shoved through Congress in a closed session without debate, hidden somewhere within an innocuous bill that no one seemed to care about anyway, in other words, with no transparency, that just might be the way you see a law like that pop up one day out of thin air without any individual congressman or party member taking the heat for it. That's about the only way a gluttonous government could pull something like that off. And there's precedent for it since the U.S. government does it all the time. Now, on that note, I'd like to read you something that's pretty devastating. It comes from a publication I like a lot called International Man, and I'm going to paraphrase and read a few excerpts of it for you. And this, by the way, is very current. Just came out a few days ago. In fact, on January 3rd. And it starts out by saying, on the 31st of December 2013, only hours after the Panamanian government gazetted a new law, shockwaves went through Panama's business community. The outcry generated demands that the law be instantly amended or repealed immediately. Now, the primary subject of Law Number 120 of 2013 had absolutely nothing to do with income taxes at all. But somehow, deep within the amendment, two articles had been inserted to amend the longstanding Panamanian tax code. And let me quote this part of the brand new law. Every natural citizen or resident, juridical, foreign or domestic, who receives any taxable income within or outside Panamanian territory must pay taxes on that income. Unquote. Then the article goes on to say, the meaning was clear. Those who pay taxes in Panama must now and in the future pay taxes based on their worldwide income instead of just their Panamanian sourced income. Just like the very same tax law in guess where? Big Brother Land, the United States. Then it says, this law was passed in total darkness. There had been no public debate, yet it was signed into law by President Ricardo Martinelli on the very last day of the 2013 congressional session, December 30th. Now, I ask you, how convenient was that? And the article goes on to say, this was obviously done with the intent to hide it and have no one notice it until it was fait accompli. There was no previous discussion of this anywhere. Nobody at all saw it coming, said high-placed financial industry and banking experts in the Panamanian business sector. Now, the next day when the news unfolded and the president was called to question, on his Twitter page he first tried to defend the law, saying that if the law needs to be defined or repealed, we must have ample debate. Yeah, right. Let's have a debate after we slipped it into an innocuous bill that no one cared about, once the business community finds out and gets totally up in arms about it. Yep, that's what I call clean, effective, transparent government. Sound familiar? Now, this is interesting. It says here, The Panamanian government grossly underestimated the outrage this would generate with the public. Officials and the president first tried to dismiss this in a business-as-usual manner, then they had to backpedal. One of the things that made them retrench their position was the fact that some heavy-hitting businessmen and powerful industrial big shots made some irate phone calls to the very top as soon as they found out. And as a result, the very next day, on December 31st, the government announced that the law will be repealed right away on the new year. Then, the article poses these questions. Are we back to normal in Panama? Can we just dismiss this as a bizarre episode, then things go right back to business as usual? Well, to that, the author says, I wish. Unfortunately, the damage to the country's credibility is already done. I don't know how grave it will be in the long run, but after this, nobody can be blamed for having second thoughts on Panama as an investment or retirement destination. Then the author adds, certainly, the world is awash with debt and many rulers are finding that they are running out of options by which to keep themselves and their governments afloat. We shall therefore see ever more drastic measures like this being taken by leaders of the world. So, we should look at this episode in Panama as a bellwether. Okay, and of course, there's a lot more to that article, but those are the highlights. Now, for what it's worth, here's my take on it. Since I actually lived in Panama a while and have been back and forth in the last couple of years, maybe 10 or 15 times, I know that country, and I also know Costa Rica and Argentina. And I can tell you this, they've all had that idea of taxing their citizens and residents on their worldwide incomes, but none of them had the balls to be first until now. Those three Latin countries in particular have very top-heavy governments and are carrying extreme unsustainable debt levels. Now, what's surprising about Panama is that the government has tremendous tax revenues from the canal. Now, this is going to shock you, and I'm sure you've never heard this before. First, let me start out by saying, it seems like a lot of people have a romantic dream of going through the Panama Canal, especially people who take personal pleasure cruises with ocean-going sailboats and such. In fact, I know a half a dozen gringos and expats who've sailed through it as a part of a personal goal on a sailing trip. Well, I hate to shatter your own dreams, but here's the reality of trying to do that. But first, let's talk about the main use of the Panama Canal, getting those big container ships through. Listen to this. If a cargo ship goes through the Panama Canal, the Canal Authority bills them at $82 per full container and $74 for an empty container. So you really don't want to have a lot of empties because that's dead weight not making you any money. Now let's take a typical container ship with, let's say, 3,800 containers. And here's a typical billing schedule. In this case, the Canal Authority charged for this one container ship $321,446 for the containers and $11,500 for the work of the 7 tugboats it took to get through the canal, $5,000 for the ground assistance helping it along, and $3,600 for the ground wires and ropes. So when your average container ship exits the other side of the canal, that transit alone will have added $750,000 to the cost of the goods on the ship. So think about it. If you bought a bicycle from China or a drill from Korea, if you're a businessman buying those things wholesale in Cleveland, a third of the cost of that product was charged up on that 50-mile trip through the Panama Canal. And by the way, the occasional luxury cruise ship goes through the Panama Canal too. Oh, and I forgot to tell you that 50-mile cruise time's about 8 to 10 hours. Anyway, get this. When a cruise ship goes through the Panama Canal, those ships are levied a fee of $150 per bed. Again, just for that 50-mile trip. And you've paid for that in the price of the cruise, so I hope it's worth it. So then what about that poor guy trying to live his lifelong dream of sailing around the world in his own personal sailboat? When he gets to the Panama Canal, what's his bill going to be? Well, in that case, it definitely pays to go small because they charge you by the length of your boat. Small ships of less than 50 feet will pay about $1,000 for the transit. A boat from 50 to 80 foot in length goes for about $1,500. 80 to 100 feet, $2,500. And above that, if it's not a commercial sailing ship, you pay $3,500. So the big question is, how much does Little Panama make a year from the Canal Authority? And of course, the Canal Authority is owned by the Chinese, so they get at least half of that money, but no one really knows the extent of the deal they have with the government of Panama, even though it's been estimated that Panama itself rakes in from $3 to $4 billion a year. That's billion with a B, from the canal fees alone. And remember, Panama's only got about 3.5 million people. To give you an idea, that's about the population of the greater Chicago area. And think about this. Panama is one of the handful of Latin American countries with comparatively high property and personal taxes, too. So you might ask, where's all that money going? To which I answer, you haven't seen how Panamanian elected officials and politicians live, and the size of their houses and vacation homes and entourages, and of course their battalions of bodyguards. Not to mention the limousines and the helicopters. They're like pigs in a trough and they still want more. In fact, they just can never get enough. That's exactly why they tried to slip in that little worldwide taxation law. And that goes for Costa Rica, Argentina, and Chile, too. For them, it's like one last big move on a chessboard, and they're chomping on the bit to do it. And they're all standing in the wings with bated breath to see what's going to happen with Panama in the new year. Because remember, the president said they're going to repeal that law right away, or at least have a debate. Well, we'll see. Remember, this is Latin America, and the term right away, when it comes to government anyway, it means maybe, maybe not, or perhaps never. Now, I understand that the mayors and the presidents and the big politicians all get a nice, big, fat kickback every time they approve another commercial project or giant skyscraper. And right now, there's over 150 such projects going up right now in Panama. In fact, a couple of months ago when I was in Panama, just looking out my hotel window, I counted over 35 industrial cranes dotting the skyline. All brand new projects under construction. All brand new projects that had to pay bribes to get those building permits, I'm sure. That's how Latin America works, not just Panama. Except, Panama is one shining example of extreme excess in corruption and everything else. Oh, and here's something I forgot to mention. The world's largest container shipping company is Maersk. You'll remember that shipping line Maersk if you watch that movie Captain Phillips with Tom Hanks. You know, the one where he gets kidnapped by Somali pirates. Anyway, in a press release, Maersk has said that after April 7th, they will no longer be using the Panama Canal at all due to costs. It turns out the Panama Canal authorities have raised their fees on canal transits 3 times in the last 3 years. And now it's actually cheaper for Maersk to send its container ships through the Suez Canal, which is a longer voyage, but they save 5 to 6% on canal charges. And even though right now the Panama Canal is undergoing a $5.25 billion expansion to handle bigger ships, still, Maersk is not taking the bait. Not to mention, there's a lot of talk and some action about putting a canal through Nicaragua. And if that happens, you can bet there'll be a canal price war, which is good for everybody except the Panama politicians. Maersk says it will only use the new expanded Panama Canal if the numbers work out, and right now, they don't. So with that, I'm sure you can see what's happening. The instantaneous loss of big revenue from the world's largest shipping company, Maersk, you think that might have something to do with the way that tax bill got buried in some other bill at the last minute and signed into law by the president on the last day of the year? I wonder. No, I guess I don't wonder. So the next question is, what'll be the next Latin country that tries to kill the goose that laid the golden egg? I'll bet you a Bitcoin it's Costa Rica. Okay, enough about that. Now, did you happen to see that little article about Cuba that came across the news services and the internet blurbs like Yahoo News, etc., just in the last few days? Well, just to refresh your memory, and if you haven't seen it, to fill you in. Last Friday, a brand new law went into effect in Cuba, allowing the common man, that is the common Cuban resident, to finally buy a new or used car in that country without obtaining a special permit. A permit that had always in the past been a bureaucratic nightmare that could take years to get approved. But the happiness was short-lived as the people who ran down to the dealerships on Friday found out that the average cost for a car was no longer 100% more than you could obtain one up in the first world, or even in nearby Latin mainland countries like Mexico and Honduras. As of Friday, they found out they could buy a car outright and get it that very day, which in Cuba was unheard of unless, of course, you were a high-placed bureaucrat. But they also found out that now cars were suddenly 400% more costly than the price you'd pay if you were up in the first world or if you'd purchased one from an adjacent Latin country on the mainland. Now, don't get me wrong. Before Friday, when cars only had a 100% markup, people were actually long accustomed to that and would save up a lifetime just to buy a car for their old age, generally a used car. Suddenly, there's that 400% markup and all that lifetime savings for a car is now out the window. In most cases now, that won't be enough, since the average Cuban still only makes about $20 to $30 a month. In the old days, it wasn't unusual for a Cuban to save up $5,000 in about 20 years. Because remember, about 15 to 25% of all Cubans get some extra money monthly or quarterly from relatives up in the States. The Latins call those gift payments from people in the States remesas, remember? And before Friday, $5,000 was enough to buy a junker that was a decent runner. Now cars like that are more like 15 grand. Now, you might be thinking, under the old permit system where there was 100% markup on cars, that was pretty terrible in itself. But you know, 100% markups like that are pretty much standard practice in island countries like Cuba, Dominican Republic, Nevis, St. Kitts, the Virgin Islands, Aruba, etc., etc. Nearly all small island countries have oppressive import taxes. Since most large manufactured products like cars, washing machines, dryers, etc., and all consumer electronic products like televisions and computers have to be imported, it's always more expensive to live on an island. That's when governments really have you by the short hairs. Oh, and I bet you didn't know that the Cuban government actually owns used car dealerships. And if on Friday you would have surveyed some of those government used car lots, you'd find the cheapest car for around $15,000. For example, on one used car lot, there was a 1997 BMW with over 200,000 kilometers on it for that rock-bottom 15 grand price. Now, if you walked over to the Havana new Hyundai and Kia dealership, you'll find a brand new Kia Rio hatchback starts for around $42,000, the same one that you can get in the States for 13 grand. Now, just one last thing about this. Like I said, in Cuba, the used car dealerships are owned and operated by the government. Now, as you well know, used car dealers are not a well-loved species of man. Now, in Cuba, it just so happens that they have a double whammy. They're also government workers. Now, if you can think of anything lower than that, let me know, because I can't. Moving on now, I must say I do get a lot of emails. I really do try to answer everyone at least with a little blurb, and some of them deserve to be read and answered on the show, like this one. And this one in particular comes from one of my new friends that came down to one of my seminars about a year or so ago. And as usual, I'll paraphrase a bit here. He starts out by saying, "Johnny, you sent a recent question out from your website asking about whether people wanted to start a business in Latin America, find a job, or what their focus was. Speaking for myself, failing is something I've done enough of, and I want to live well. So currently, I'm looking for how I can find first world work overseas. I'm too young to retire, and I'm looking for sure things now. So as far as being a small business person down there, my heart just isn't focused on that. I feel you have to be all in to make a business work, and if anything, I just want to read more and pursue self-improvement activities. Being smarter, reading more, etc. I get focused on learning and don't want to stop. I don't want to go on and on here, but just to help on your end, this potential expat would love to hear more about finding work overseas and not just limited to Latin America even. You yourself have had to have run into plenty of expats with experience with this type of employment. What I'm doing is elaborating a little more about that question you asked about business and job focus for future expats." And he signs off, "Regards, Mr. P." Okay then, Mr. P, let's discuss this a little bit. First, let's talk about sure things. Well, like Expat Eddie says, not even winning the lottery is a sure thing. You could get killed walking across the street to pick up your check. Especially, like Eddie says, if you've been celebrating and buying rounds for everyone for the past 4 or 5 days. But as many long-term expats I know down here will tell you, even if you start a business here and do it half-ass, the odds are still with you that it's going to be a success as long as your competition in business are the Latins or other third world competition, and not gringos or first worlders. And that's why it can be an unfortunate mistake to locate a business in a high-volume gringo tourist area. But it is true I have run across a lot of gringos and expats who do work down here for first world companies, as executives and middle management for 3M and Bayer and Nestle, Walmart, Sears, and yes, believe it or not, they make first world salaries too, which means down here they're living like royalty, provided, of course, they're not living in the so-called Zona Viva or Zona Rosa. And here I'm talking about the sections in big city Latin America where all the international business and banking takes place and where you have your Hiltons and Radissons, your convention centers and the first world restaurants and hotels. Because you see, if you choose to work and play in those areas of the big city, you'll be paying first world prices. Because you see, in every medium and large-sized Latin American city, there's a first world style enclave with a lot of first world shopping, including hotels, restaurants, entertainment and such. And that, by the way, is where all the embassies are too and where all the embassy personnel hang out, so businesses and restaurants and such located there can get first world prices because they're catering to first world people like embassy folks and conventioners who make first world salaries. Not to mention, that's where all the scumbag politicians hang out too, to show off their power and spend the money that they've swindled from the masses. Makes sense, right? And personally, I keep my distance from those people and places. I left the first world to get away from that kind of stuff. So bottom line, if you make a first world salary and choose to work and play and live in the so-called Zona Rosa or Zona Viva areas, you'd live quite nicely, but not like a king or queen, as you would living off the tourist trail away from the main business and hotel district. And again, speaking of expats who earn first world salaries, I know some expats in management positions in big international mining companies down here with home offices in the UK and Canada. So how did they get those jobs? Well, they were either recruited when up in the States, or they answered ads in the back of business magazines like Forbes, Business Week, and The Economist. And there are also foreign placement want ads in various professional magazines, like, for example, IEEE magazine, which is a nerdy engineering rag that I used to get. And of course, if you are a professional, whether you're a chemist or a geologist, whatever, you can look up your specialty rag on the internet and check out the want ads there too. And don't forget those overseas job ads in big newspapers like the Chicago Tribune, LA Times, New York Times, and that funky orange UK newspaper, the Financial Times. They've all got sections for foreign placement job ads. But I will tell you one thing, you'll almost never get the job if you don't speak the language in the country they're going to place you in. And I just don't mean being able to understand Spanish, Portuguese, or Indonesian soap operas. I mean being able to read, write, and speak in a business sense. Because you see, you can't come to a third world country, Latin or otherwise, and impart your special gringo skills if you can't communicate it to the locals and the people you're working with in their language. And if you're thinking of getting a job with an international NGO in Latin America, for example, they do advertise those jobs in the papers down here in English. But again, one of the job requisites is that you're going to have to know Spanish. And by the way, these NGOs, which are ONGs in English, you know, those do-gooder organizations I always talk about. Anyway, if you get a job with them, you'll make about half of the first world salary you'd make if you were up in the first world. For example, if they hire you as an accountant, you might get 40 grand a year instead of 80. And on that, you'll be living like royalty, if you follow my advice. So bottom line, if you're coming to the third world and looking for a job that pays first world salary, working for the man, that is, you'll have to know the language and get recruited from up in the States. If you think you'll get a job like that, coming down and beating on doors yourself, that's not going to happen.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, living in Latin America, coming to you twice a week from somewhere south of the border. Email me, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out expatwisdom.com to sign up for your free reports on Latin America. See you next time. Nos vemos. She was a picture.